You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 20th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, live to tape, you say. Why is that, Sam? An unruly live audience? Was there an emergency? Is everything okay? Yes, folks. Everything is okay. In fact, everything's better than okay. And by that, I mean I'm on vacation. And I have actually pre-taped this. In other words, as I speak into this microphone now, I am speaking to you in the future. You hear my voice in the future from the time that I've recorded this. And as we speak, for you, it's a normal day. For me, I am at home with my daughter because she has vacation. And as you know, my 6.5-year-old daughter is essentially my boss. She dictates everything that I do. She's the reason why I have very little fun in my life. She's the reason why I am constantly working to keep her in the luxury that she is accustomed to. Right now, I am sure that we are driving around her mini FOA Schwartz or Brookstone Bentley. It's probably a little electric car. It's probably one of those like studded Bentleys that all kids of driving around. It's probably gas powered. She probably forced me to get it this morning. So folks, but that doesn't mean that we don't have a great show for you today. In fact, we do, with all new, never heard before in any venue whatsoever content, straight from the, right off the Majority Report presses. Today on the program, I'll be interviewing Richard Eskow from Campaign for America's Future on a guy named Edward DeMarco. And I don't know, maybe this is hyperbole, but he probably holds the key to helping out our foreclosure mortgage crisis in this country more than any single individual in the country. And it turns out he won't do it. We'll be talking to R.J. Eskow about that in just a moment. And following the interview with Richard Eskow will be an interview that I did a couple of weeks ago at the 2012 Health Action Conference put on by Families USA. I'll be talking to Ron Pollack, the founder of Families USA. And over the course of the week, we'll have a couple more interviews from Families USA. Both to look into what the Affordable Care Act is and isn't doing, and to look forward to the big Supreme Court case over the course of 3 days. It's coming up in just probably exactly a month from now, late March. And there are three big issues in that Supreme Court case. Over the course of the week, we'll be talking to people about that. Also, over the course of the week, I'll be talking to Lawrence Lessig, the Harvard law professor who developed Creative Commons and is now been working for the past couple of years on how to essentially fix our democracy. Also on the program this week, I'll be talking to Congressman John Sarbanes, who I spoke to, like I say, about 3 or 4 weeks ago at the Families USA Conference, Health Action 2012, about SOPA, the SOPA fight, and what that means also for clean elections. And later this week, we'll be talking to the folks at JustCoffee.coop who sponsor this program. And we'll also be talking to Derek Jensen. He is a, I guess the best way to describe him is an author and radical environmentalist. And then, if you can believe it, I take just a brief moment out of my life, essentially, to talk about something that is not political. Dimitar Sazlov, and maybe in a way it is. He is a renowned astronomer at Harvard, and he thinks they found another Earth. That may be exaggerating a bit, but he's doing stuff like, you know, figuring out how life began and small stuff. He's working on the small stuff. We'll be talking to him later in the week. So make sure that you tune in for the rest of the week, and you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. Of course, you can also support this program by buying your Amazon junk through our link at majority.fm, support the show. But becoming a member is really, that makes a huge difference. It will keep this show alive. So enjoy Richard Eskow and Ron Pollack today, and we'll be back tomorrow with some new, fresh content. Enjoy. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome back to this program Richard Eskow. He is a writer and analyst and senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Hey, always great to talk with you, Sam.
All right, so you got a piece up that was from last week on February 13th on Edward DeMarco. And this guy is probably, I think he is one of the most important people in our government that people know virtually nothing about, rarely hear his name, and he is the head of, or I should say, I guess, is he still just acting director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency? Is that right?
He's still named as acting director, but he's been there for years. And for 3 years, and because the Republicans refused to confirm Obama's permanent appointment to that position, who's very centrist, as you can imagine, very non-aligned, reasonable guy, this guy, Ed DeMarco, is almost guaranteed to be able to stay there unless the White House wants to fight the legality of the situation, which it doesn't seem to want to do. So he's acting director, but he's been acting for 3 years, and he's likely to keep acting.
I was going to say, I just want to make it absolutely clear that when I say you wrote this piece on February 13th, you wrote it in February 13th of 2012, not February 13th of 2009.
Yeah, when you say, gee, this guy's been here a month or two too long, that's what I would have written in 2009.
All right, well, so let's back up for a moment. Now, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, what do they do?
Well, that's basically a roll-up of several different agencies that were assigned to make sure that people got fair, reasonable, government-backed home loans, mortgages. And this goes back, this has been around for many years, worked terrifically throughout the 50s and 60s, and then Lyndon Johnson wanted to take the cost of these loans off the books because the war in Vietnam was making his budget look too bad. So they quote-unquote privatized it, and out of that came Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two big mortgage securitization firms that were really government-backed, government-sponsored, but allowed to be put in the hands of private sector guys who paid themselves millions and millions and behaved incredibly irresponsibly and followed the whole herd instinct of Wall Street that crashed the economy. So we had to take them back. We had to rescue them. We had to sink $150 billion or so into making them right. And all of a sudden, this guy, Ed DeMarco, who's a Bush appointee, first, I think, to Social Security when Bush wanted to privatize Social Security, and then to the FHFA, this acting director all of a sudden became the czar of, you know, how they love to use that word czar on the right for somebody who has too much power in government. He became the czar of more than half the home loans in this country.
Right.
So he's an incredibly powerful guy who's ideologically opposed to government helping homeowners, which is the mission of his agency, and we can't seem to get rid of him.
All right, well, let's back up just a little bit more, because I want to dig into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because I think people are not clear on what this agency did before the financial crisis and what its relationship with government was and now is. Because really, they're two different sort of relationships that changed after the financial crisis. So back in the 2000s, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac simply enjoyed the government as sort of a guarantor of the business it was doing. And so what did it do at that time, and really just outline what that relationship with the government was?
Well, first of all, let's talk about what they didn't do, because conservatives love to say that subprime mortgages blew up the economy because all those undeserving poor people were given homes. Actually, subprime mortgages aren't any worse. I mean, the mortgage collapse was the entire real estate, luxury homes, commercial, everything else. But what those two organizations did was they started doing the same speculating, gambling. They followed Wall Street. When Wall Street got into derivatives, when it got into mortgage-backed securities, when it got into packaging and fooling people and over-leveraging and gambling with money they didn't have, they went right along with it. So think of them as kind of herd followers of the Goldman Sachs mentality, but ones that had a huge portfolio built up and guaranteed by the U.S. government. And yet, because of this, this is something created by government for social purposes, backed by the taxpayer, and yet these guys with this crazy notion of privatization were allowed to just spend a fortune and on themselves, take enormous risks with the whole economic system. And, you know, it's like Sallie Mae that was also privatized for student loans. Sallie Mae bought themselves three corporate jets. These guys, you know, did similar kind of, you know, life of Julius Caesar things. And when they got in trouble, they came back to the government and the taxpayer to be rescued. And
so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were basically sort of the ultimate example of socializing the risks, because it allowed for mortgages, it allowed for more home ownership, and allowed for more stability in the banking industry. But they followed in the mid 2000s, around 2006, 2005, they found that they were holding less of a portfolio of these mortgage securities than their counterparts in the fully private industry, and so they started picking them up, but they had the benefit of being backed by the government, but they still functioned like their counterparts in the private industry in terms of lavish bonuses and lavish extravagant amenities and benefits. And so,
right, a study afterwards found that throughout the 2000s, they manipulated accounting, which I thought was illegal, but they manipulated accounting. One regulator called it the worst run financial institution he'd ever seen in 30 years as a regulator. The CEO made $65 million between 2000 and 2008. I mean, it goes on and on. He said, you know, the CEO, Daniel Mudd, said, I write my own rules with regulators. We always win. We take no prisoners. You know, that was their attitude. But and remember, they didn't even have to sell anything because the government brought this to them. So they just were backed by the government, coddled by the taxpayer, and, you know, taking out tens of millions of dollars for themselves.
So, so now we have DeMarco. This is then in 2008, because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at that point were backstopping essentially 50% of the country's mortgages. They needed a big bailout, and so the government took them over fully. Is that correct?
Right, absolutely.
Except
so
for...
we took over. So the CEO of Fannie Mae and the CEO of Freddie Mac and all their senior executives report to Ed DeMarco.
And while the government took all this responsibility, didn't have quite full control, at least the new government, in appointing somebody that was more responsible in some respects in terms of following through on the mission. Now, what is the mission of the FHFA?
Well, yes, and just to be clear, it's so insane that because it's supposedly an independent agency, Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, can't tell them what to do. Barack Obama technically can't tell them what to do unless he goes to court. So this is, you know, that's the situation we're dealing with, and Tim Geithner's furious at this guy from the left. Larry Summers is furious at this guy from the left. That's how far we are. And their mission is clearly stated, whether it's Fannie or Freddie or the agency itself. Their mission is to, quote, stabilize the nation's residential mortgage markets and expand opportunities for home ownership and, get this, affordable rental housing, and on the Freddie Mac website, its three key functions: make homeownership and rental housing more affordable, reduce the number of foreclosures, got that, that's number two of three, helping families keep their homes, that's number three of three. There's nothing in there about what our next topic is probably going to be, which is gambling and trying to get the best return on their dollar.
Well, yeah. So let's talk about that now. The real issue here, the biggest problem with DeMarco is that there are steps he can take to fulfill those mandates that you just mentioned, helping stabilize the housing market, keep families in their homes. How could he go about doing this?
Very simple. With these agencies under his command, which they are, he can, for more than half the mortgages in the country, he can immediately turn around and say, for $100 billion of underwater mortgages, your interest rates go down, and based on the following rules, we can reduce X percent of the principal you owe on that underwater mortgage. He could do that with a stroke of a pen. In fact, they actually had a pilot program to see if they could do that and how it would work. It was going great, but according to one of FHFA's employees who testified before Congress, senior executives shut the whole program down because they were ideologically opposed. I think those were his exact words. I'm not sure. Ideologically opposed to helping the homeowners in this way.
Now, we should make it clear, the idea of doing a loan modification and doing principal reduction, these are not crazy radical ideas. In fact, HAMP, the Home Adjustable Mortgage Program, has been set up to just encourage private banks to do that very thing. But we're in a position, theoretically, where instead of having to encourage and create incentives to get private industry to do that, when it comes to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, theoretically, like you just said, this can be done with just the stroke of a pen.
And let's make it really simple. There's a family out there. There are a million of them, actually. Let's pick one family out there. They're underwater on their home. Maybe the bank appraiser lied to them about what it was worth. Who knows? Whatever. They're underwater on their home by $100,000. They're barely making their payments, if that, and they're paying 7% interest.
All right. Now, wait a second. Let me just make it clear to what people, so that when we say underwater, they bought the house for $300,000.
Right.
And their mortgage,
and now it's worth
$200,000,
and that could be because,
and they have a $250,000 mortgage, let's say.
Right. Okay. So they owe $50,000 that they can never get back. as well as the other 200. So here they are now struggling to get by, and they're paying 7% interest when you can go out and get a mortgage today if you qualify for around 4%.
So why don't these homeowners just go and do that?
Because they can't get it, because they don't have collateral, because their home isn't worth $250,000 anymore.
So they can't refinance.
So this is what DeMarco could fix. He could fix it tomorrow, and he won't do it. Now, given that their job is to prevent foreclosures, that family's headed straight for a foreclosure. They can't make payments at 7%. They can't pay off at $250,000. DeMarco could step in, reduce that principal, change the rules to make it easier for them to get a lower interest lock, which, by the way, the Fed has driven the interest rates way down, so banks are making a fortune on it. He could set it up so that that family could get that lower interest loan. Maybe you know what he did instead? He made it harder for them to refinance. He added new charges to refinancing a loan through his agencies. So now that family's going down.
And so Ed DeMarco would say, well, the reason why we can't do this is because we have a fiscal fiduciary responsibility to not essentially, because we're going to lose money on this loan long term if we reduce the principal and if we reduce the interest rate. Obviously, if we drop the interest rate from 7% down to what market rates are now, 4.5%, even though we will probably make it more likely that the homeowners will be able to pay for this loan over the course of 30 years, let's say, we're cutting the value of that loan. But his own claim, his own argument, is undercut by the fact that you're going to lose much more if the home goes into foreclosure.
Right, exactly. I mean, he has been untruthful, frankly, about a lot of this. He told Congress that it would cost $100 billion to write down underwater mortgages. Well, that's if you wrote down every penny on every single one. And even so, his own staff, his own research department has said that writing down principal as well as refinancing will save the taxpayer $20 billion. So I can't emphasize that more. Ed DeMarco's excuse for not doing this is that his primary responsibility is to manage the taxpayers' money well. But if he really felt that way, the best way to manage our money is by putting through the programs that the government wants them to put through, that we just talked about. He's costing us $20 billion because of his ideology.
And to make not to put a too fine a point on it, like you say, he lied when he says $100 billion. He's talking about an expense that nobody's suggesting, because he's talking about the full extent of the value of these loans rather than just the fraction of which you would actually reduce in terms of principal cost. And when the people who are working for him saying we'll save the taxpayers $20 billion, those projections are based upon the losses you take if all these homes actually a certain percentage of these homes go into foreclosure and have to do some type of short sale, which is basically to sell the house at a vast reduction and not allowing for those people who sell the homes to pay off the original mortgage. So I don't understand, you know, what is his agenda here? I mean, you've mentioned that he has an ideology, he comes from the book, but is somebody benefiting by him not doing this?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think, number one, ideology, and then there's the qui bono part. I mean, and who benefits? But in terms of who benefits, you know, if a bank, for example, isn't put under pressure to write down all the artificial assets it's got on its books, because, you know, our banks in the private sector are carrying these artificially inflated real estate values as real value, that could hurt them in the stock market. So that could hurt their earnings. So they don't want to do that. And so he's certainly helping them. And then you get, you know, this happened during the Great Depression, too, when Treasury Secretary Mellon under Hoover said, let them all go down, let the shit hit the fan. And he didn't use those words, though, it being 1929, that and then it'll all settle out in a sort of market-driven sort of way. I got to assume that that's Ed DeMarco's ideology. I don't know, because one of the things that DeMarco does is he turns down a lot of interviews, except with friendly journalists, which means he won't communicate with his employers, the American people. And he almost got hit with a subpoena from Congress because he wasn't giving them the answers they had requested. They had to threaten him before he finally gave Elijah Cummings and another member of Congress answers to the questions they demanded. So, you know, it's hard to know what he's thinking, but that's sure the way it looks.
So, and now we have this very strange situation because of the nature of the FHFA, President Obama why can't he just fire this guy?
Well, you know, he could. I mean, he could try, because the law, according to experts, is unclear. So he could go to court and slam this guy, but, you know, maybe out of appropriate caution or for whatever reason, he's not doing it. I mean, you know, I believe in this case, you know, I tend to be a cynic, but in this case, I tend to believe he's really frustrated because, you know, I've met Tim Geithner, I've talked to Geithner off the record. If you're ticking off Tim Geithner, you really are a bad actor on this topic. And, you know, if you've got Larry Summers slamming you in print, as Ed DeMarco does, I really believe that's an expression that the administration is frustrated with the guy but doesn't want to take on that battle right now. So, you know, I guess if they don't fight him in court, then he's who we've got, and until the Republicans confirm Obama's nominee, which they're not going to do.
Do you think let's just to sum up in terms of Edward DeMarco, he has failed to carry out at least you could argue at least the majority of his mandate at the FHFA. I think you have a very good argument that he's failed to carry out the entire mandate, frankly. He has intentionally or not, as you wrote, misled Congress and the public in terms of the questions of, A, have they ever done a pilot program? B, what were the results of that pilot program? C, how much money would be saved if they did principal reduction and loan modification? And D, how much money this would actually cost if you would go into providing these principal reduction and loan modifications? He overstated that. So he's essentially, I'm going to use the word, lied to Congress, maybe willfully, maybe mistakenly, which shows a certain lack of competence. And he's also stonewalled Congress, and the Obama administration could go to court. What do you think could happen in a second term? I mean, do you think that, I mean, I imagine the Republicans would still stonewall a head of the committee, particularly if they are of the agency, I should say, if they believe that there is no way to get rid of DeMarco. Do you think that the Obama administration in a second term will be more aggressive? What can change here?
Well, you know, I don't think anybody's predicting that the Democrats retake Congress. Maybe they are. But so under your scenario, Obama could take this situation to court, or there could be a huge public campaign, which I'd love to see, to get this guy out and demanding that your representative explain why he isn't doing more to get rid of this guy who's hurting American middle-class homeowners. And the only other thing that I can see is, in addition to suing over, you know, the appointment process and whether he really is unfireable, I think there's a good case to be made somewhere that, you know, I mean, the word impeachment comes to mind, although I'm sure it's not the right word, but I see this as a guy who is refusing to carry out his mission, his mandate, and has been, you say lying, I say, well, lying's good, actually, you know, to Congress and the public, certainly misleading. I would say there's a good argument there that this guy's got to go either voluntarily or involuntarily.
Give me your sense of what you think should happen to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as time goes on. I mean, should we have a government-sponsored entity like this when we can see the abuses? I mean, I think for too long we relied on the responsibility of the leaders of these quasi, I don't know if it's fair to call them quasi-private or quasi-government. I mean, they're basically subsidized private industries. Have we gone?
Yeah, they're called. I'll tell you exactly. I mean, the Democrats have already put out through one of their think tanks a proposal for reprivatizing them. And, of course, that's what the Republicans want. I think that's insane. I think that it worked great for 30 years or so until Johnson had to take it off the books. I think that there are some functions that government does better. And I think backstopping student loans is one of them. I think backstopping mortgages is another. I think they should stay government managed. And I think that the process should change. There needs to be more, caution, new rules for, technical stuff that we can go into if you want to or don't have to. But I think that, bottom line, I think this is something that government did well for 30 years, and then the private sector screwed it up. And, okay, lesson learned. Government can do it. Private sector can't. Leave it with the government.
Well, I mean, do we need more government control of this, or just more government accountability from these agencies, from these entities? Clearly they've run amok, or there's not enough governmental control to get them to do the stuff that they should be doing from a governmental policy standpoint. I mean, they don't seem to be behaving in a way that is benefiting the American public at a time when we need them to do this the most.
Correct. So the answer to that is to stop pretending. You know, the cover story that DeMarco and his pals can use is, well, if we don't get this thing financially stabilized, which they're not doing, they're lying about that, but the cover story is, if we don't get this thing financially stabilized, then how can we reprivatize it because it won't be on a strong footing? The answer is fine. We're not going to reprivatize it. We're breaking up. Those names can go away, Fannie, Freddie, lose them, lose that whole structure, go back to the way it was in 1968, working great, then change the policies and practices going forward. But first and foremost, let's stop pretending that you can privatize something and give somebody a blank check from the taxpayer, and he's not going to do what Daniel Mudd did, which is pay himself $65 million to screw up the whole economy, because that's what they'll do again.
Yeah, that's good money, even if you're not screwing up the economy.
Exactly. That's the way I feel about it.
Richard Esgow from Campaign for America's Future, thanks so much. And are you familiar with any programs or any attempts out there to get to put pressure on this guy? I mean, obviously it helps when we talk to a writer who's digging in and explaining it to people. Is there something that my listeners can do to help ratchet up the pressure, to spread this word? I mean, aside from, we will link your piece, obviously, at majority.fm, spreading that around is helpful. Information always is. But is there any actions that you're aware of that they can take?
I think we're going to do one at ourfuture.org, so I would tell them to check there. And I believe that someone has already started. I think I saw one today or yesterday, but it's not coming into mind right away. But I would say, ourfuture.org, there's going to be something there pretty soon that says, do something about this DeMarco guy.
Okay. Well, we'll keep our eyes open and see if there's any other attempts out there to put pressure on DeMarco, and we will put that alongside the link to your piece on majority.fn. Richard Esgow, thanks again for your time.
My pleasure, Sam. Thanks.
Okay, we continue with our coverage from Health Action 2012, put on by Families USA, and we are fortunate enough to have Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA, with us. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
What does Families USA do? I mean, aside from the conference.
Well, we've been in operation for about 30 years, and we're the advocate for healthcare consumers. Our mission is to achieve high quality, affordable health coverage and care for everybody. So for years, we've been trying to promote significant health reform. And of course, we played a significant role trying to help get the Affordable Care Act passed. We worked closely with the president and his administration. and key leaders of Congress to get the Affordable Care Act passed. And now we're trying to make sure that the Affordable Care Act is implemented in a vigorous way in states all across the country.
I want to ask you how you ended up in this, but I'm very interested. There was a story recently, Talking Points memo Brian Beutler did, about the difficulty that a theoretical President Romney or President Republican would have in essentially unwinding what has already taken place in terms of moving towards the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. But when you talk about the vigorous implementation of it, where is the difference between non-vigorous and vigorous implementation take place? What things need to happen for it to be vigorous as opposed to just happen?
Well, let me give you a few examples. One of the key things that the Affordable Care Act does is it creates a new marketplace. They call them exchanges, where private insurance companies, that's where they're going to be selling their coverage. Now, who's going to control those exchanges? Will they be controlled by insurance companies, or will they be controlled by consumers? Because there's very important regulation that needs to take place. I mean, for example, insurers are not supposed to deny coverage due to a pre-existing condition or charge higher premiums due to a health status. There's supposed to be careful review about proposed premium increases. There's an outlawing of placing a cap, a ceiling, on how much an insurance company will pay out when you get sick, like lifetime or annual caps. So there is a lot of regulation that needs to take place.
The proportion of you need to spend 80% on actual care as opposed to...
Excellent point. There is now a requirement that the overwhelming majority of the premium dollar must be spent on health care, not on marketing, advertising, administration, and profits. And as you said, for small plans, they've got to pay at least 80 cents out of the dollar for health care as opposed to those other things.
And what gets defined as health care, what is on the a la carte menu?
Let me make one other point about this. For larger plans, they've got to spend at least 85 cents out of the dollar. And so this is very important oversight that needs to take place. You know, when I pay a premium, I don't want the money to be spent on administrative costs, marketing and advertising, and profits. I don't care about that. I don't begrudge a company for wanting to make a profit, but that's not how I want to spend my money. I want to spend money for my health care, or if I'm an employer, to pay for the health care of people who work in the office. And so this is a very important thing that needs to be regulated. So is the fox going to be in the chicken coop, or are there going to be people who will be running these exchanges who are consumer-friendly, who are going to be vigorous in the enforcement?
So in other words, the Affordable Care Act sets up bodies of regulation for these exchanges, but who sits on them is going to be very important.
It's absolutely important. And, you know, these exchanges have got a lot of discretionary decisions to make. For example,
To clarify, I'm sorry, are these state-by-state exchanges?
Yes, they are. And so if you're a passive exchange and, you know, you're captured by the insurance companies, you're essentially going to say, we'll take all comers. We'll take any plan. We don't care how bad it is or how good it is. They can sell their wares. If you're really trying to protect consumers, you're going to look at the coverage that is being provided, the cost for that coverage, you know, the kind of service that's being provided. So you can actually play a role in determining which plans will be allowed to sell their coverage in the exchange. So it makes a huge difference.
Now, I mean, I want to get back to this element because I imagine it changes Families USA mission in some respects from a national focus to a state-by-state focus. But I want to get back in a second. But help my audience conceptualize this exchange. It's available to individuals. How is it different than what exists now?
You know, right now, People want to buy coverage on their own. It's a Wild West.
Right.
And, you know, it's a Wild West in so many different ways. If you've got a pre-existing health condition, insurer says, we're not going to cover you. They have, before the Affordable Care Act, they placed lifetime or annual caps on what they were willing to spend out. The information they provided to you in terms of what they're covering, what the costs you're going to bear, often are indecipherable, and you can't compare apples to apples. You're comparing apples to elephants. So now there's going to be a marketplace with certain rules, and those rules are going to help put all of this on the side of the consumer.
So by exchange, we just mean a regulatory framework.
Framework. And it's a way of making sure that products that are available to people are decent products.
And can you be an insurance company and sell to individuals and not be part of an exchange?
Yes, you can, but you're probably not going to have too many clients.
Because you're going to be at a distinct advantage because you're not going to essentially have the approval of being within the regulatory framework.
One of the things about the Affordable Care Act that's very important for middle-class families is that if you're middle-class, you can get a tax credit subsidy for a purchase of coverage. And this tax credit subsidy extends pretty high up. It goes to 400% of the federal poverty level. So for a family of four, if you have an income below $90,000, you're eligible for a tax credit to help you pay for your premiums. If you're in a family of three, 400% of poverty is up to $75,000. You can get a tax credit when you purchase coverage. So if I'm a middle-class person and I'm having difficulty affording health insurance, I'm going to want to buy a plan in the exchange
because I'm going to get a tax credit subsidy.
So it's going to limit the clients that insurers can get if they're simply outside the exchange.
Interesting. And so getting back to that idea that you have the biggest challenge is going to be how we implement those, and it's going to be a function of who sits on those exchanges. So my question to you is who appoints the people on those exchanges, and does this change the mission of Families USA in the at least the short or midterm to sort of influence on a state-by-state basis how they're picked, or is it to create a sort of broader national awareness of that these decisions are important?
From day one, we at Families USA have worked both at the federal level and at the state level. The people who are here are all state activists. We work with them all the time. And so, you know, before there was health reform, the key changes were occurring at the state level. You know, and so we've been very active in that. We obviously been very active at the federal level, and we will continue to be, because the federal government is going to be issuing the federal regulations that the states need to comply with, and we're going to be very active at the state level because that's where the key decisions are going to be made. So it doesn't change our mission. It changes the focus somewhat. You know, before, we were trying to make sure that health reform would be a high priority on the national agenda and in state agendas across the country. Well, now we've got that. So now we've got to implement this and implement it effectively. But working hand in hand at the national level and at the state level is something that will continue.
Who will appoint the members of the regulatory commissions?
They're going to be decided state by state. And that
so
might
even
be
how they're constructed and how many people sit on it and what department will be overseeing these exchanges?
Essentially all of the above. And it'll probably, in many states, it'll be written out in legislation, and then they'll delegate to somebody, the governor or whoever, to make the appointments. In some instances, actually, the governor will create an exchange through executive orders or through some other process. So in each of the states, it's somewhat different, and it's also going – so substantively and procedurally, it's going to be different.
Wow. And – is there any mechanism on the federal level to force the states to do the right thing in these situations? I mean, you know, you could have a very pro business-friendly governor who decides that, you know, in our state we're going to have a regulatory agency that's going to consider, you know, that that 80-20 split, for instance, or 85-15% split. You know, things like dental and eye care and anything but a very narrow subset of medical care would be, is what you need to spend your premiums on. The rest can be a la carte and we can have a different percentage.
Well, there are many different answers to that question. The first thing before I answer that question is that you can be business friendly and want a rigorous exchange. Because remember, small businesses will be able to buy coverage through the exchange.
Right.
It's not just individuals. Well, if you want to be business friendly, you want to protect the small business owner.
Let me amend by saying insurance business friendly.
All right. Well, that's that is an appropriate amendment.
Right.
So to answer your question, first, there are federal rules that get established. And so the 80-20 and the 85-15 rule, that's nationwide. Now, how vigorously that's enforced, that's a different question.
Right.
And there are other rules that are national rules that every state is going to have to comply with. But there's another facet of all this, and that is those states that don't set up meaningful exchanges, or states like Louisiana that say we're not going to establish an exchange at all, federal government will establish the exchange.
And for that state.
Correct.
And so they will impose certain regulations for insurance that will be sold in that state.
They will function like an exchange. That's right.
And why would that state abdicate that responsibility and, I would think, opportunity?
If you want me to oversimplify, I'll oversimplify with one word. Right. Politics.
Right.
You know, right now, you've got a number of governors who, if they want one thing, they want to make sure President Obama does not get reelected. And so part of the way they want to sort of hurt President Obama is to make sure that the Affordable Care Act is not implemented and certainly isn't implemented in a vigorous fashion.
Or at the very least is talked about as an issue of contention in the run-up to the election.
And so the conservative governors who may want to run for president 4 years or 8 years from now, they want to show they were leaders against Obamacare, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's an irony in all this. And the irony is, if you're a very conservative governor and you say, to hell with it, I don't want to implement the Affordable Care Act, well, good, then the federal government's going to come in and implement it in your state. Now, how is that a conservative thing to try to promote?
And the irony is it also increases the chances that it's going to be implemented well, which is going to be of benefit to your citizens and may end up for that very election that you have 4 to 8 years down the road, pardon my French, bite you in the butt. Because you're running against something that people at that time may actually really appreciate.
That's absolutely right.
Well, Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA, I really appreciate your time today.
I'm delighted to be with you, and I hope
you've done
join
here.
Us for the next 20 years at our Health Action Conference.
Well, I hope to as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Satan, I prepare.